Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room, Barbara Sittler is speaking on choosing death, hospice versus physician-assisted suicide. So let's listen in on Barbara Sittler.
I want to say right off the bat that I don't have any definitive position that I'm going to take here, nor do I have any solutions to this whole question about physician-assisted suicide and hospice and all of that. And I see this, I would be very happy if you felt comfortable with interrupting me at any point and we could get a conversation going here, because I think this is really something that it lends itself to conversation a great deal. But I titled this particular section, Choosing Death, and putting the two different things together of hospice versus physician-assisted suicide, because I think that what we're faced with now technologically is in a sense, it is true that we are choosing death, which is a funny kind of idea because death comes to all of us. But up until recently, we had very little to say about how that death came about, when it happened, and what our responses to it were going to be. And that's changed a lot because of medical technology. And I think there's some very serious questions about how we can start to continue to lift up the values that we have for life and carry those into how we deal with our death. So when I think about death, I have to think, first of all, what it is that makes life so significant. And for example, today, I was wandering around after I took my shower, after my garbage detail, warming up in the sun, feeling this incredible air drying out my hair, looking at how beautiful it was. And I love the fact that I can just walk around and do what I want, choose to be here, have a life that really is my own. I'm also up here for this first week of two on my own, and I'm very much looking forward on Saturday to having my sister and her family join me, because I feel lonely here a little bit. And I recognize that part of what makes life also worth living is my relationality to other people. And I think that those are sort of primary values that most people, or primary characteristics of what makes a life meaningful. There are also things that we have to carry into how we consider death. It seems to me that in recent times, we have sort of said, okay, we don't know how we're going to die. We don't know when we're going to die. We are, many of us, very suspicious or uneasy with letting our death be handled by other people, particularly medical people who we often have very little relationship with. And so we have to reflect, we have to think about what our options are. And I think that there's been an artificial division created and how we think about what our options are. I think Jack Kevorkian has helped to bring up the issue of how we deal with our life, the fact that, and how we deal with our death, the fact that death is getting away from us. It's being taken away from our center. And we have very few options. We either allow ourselves to be brutalized by the medical profession, or we allow some saint like Jack Kevorkian to come in and take care of it for us. That's a very strange and artificial scenario. And because it makes great stories, I think the press has helped to create this sense that we have to either find a great doctor or we have to fill out advance directives, get in touch with Jack Kevorkian, figure out how long we can manage to be who we are as we are today. And when we stop being who we are as we are today, then we've got to make some very serious steps to ending life. That doesn't work very well, I don't think. And I have looked around to see what groups who I would hope would have something to say about what life and death are have had to say about this issue, particularly the church. And before I get into that, because the church, the Lutheran church, for those of us who are Lutheran, has come out with a statement, which I have here. But I think that, just to get back on this, I'm not putting this as clearly as I wish, but we see life as essentially not a natural phenomenon any longer. It's either going to happen in the hospital with a great deal of technology keeping us alive beyond the point that we want to be kept alive, or perhaps keeping us alive as long as we possibly can be, which is exactly what we want. It can come around as a result of withdrawing sort of extraordinary treatment so that we are allowed to die. It can happen in a very active way in which we contact someone like Jack Kevorkian, who comes in and accomplishes our death for us when we want it, as we want it, before we are stripped of our dignity. It can happen through the help of a physician, our physician, in a passive way, by allowing us to have as much pain medication and palliative measures around, so that at when we find that we are no longer able to bear the suffering, we have an adequate amount or dosage of narcotics that we can dispatch ourselves. We can go to a physician and say, look, I want you to give me some cocktail that'll end my suffering. I'm coming to you. I want you to kill me. Or we can think, which is something that I think has not been brought up as often as it ought to be, or we can think about saying, when we are in the final phase of life, when we're in the final phase of an illness, when we are no longer talking about being cured of an illness, when we have to recognize that we are going to be dying, can we effect some kind of shift in care so that we continue to receive treatment, we continue to receive care, which, after all, somebody said to me, there's no one who wants no treatment, who wants no care. Is there some way we can assist the process of dying in, say, a hospice, so that we can recognize death, we can recognize the diminishment that we're facing, we can recognize the suffering that we're being put through and we're putting our families through, but we can diminish that suffering without stopping life, without saying, I draw a line in the sand, here I will, past this point I will go no further. And I'm wondering if there's a way in which we can think about death in the same way that we think about life. It's a process. It contains some moments of joy, certainly in the people who I've been with who have died and have been in the process of dying. There have been some very joyful moments that probably would never have happened if they hadn't known they were dying. There's this almost a freedom to say and do and be things to each other that for some reason we don't allow during the normal times of life. There's also a great deal of suffering, I think, in death. And I wonder if we, as a society, as a nation, and perhaps as a church body, ought to think about suffering in some different ways. Is suffering always bad? Should we always do everything we can to end suffering? Is the excuse that someone was suffering terribly reason enough to say, well, call on Jack Kevorkian? Or could there be ways in which we can comprehend suffering and say that it's permissible, it's allowable, it's okay, up to a point, and then really act positively to help relieve suffering in ways that are not in the back of a van somewhere. Now, I want to stop that for a moment and say that the Lutheran Church, the ELCA, has put out a message. It's apparently a message is less, it's a statement, it's not a definitive statement, it's not, it doesn't carry the same weight as some of the other, I forget what the other names of things are that the church comes out with, but it's a, it addresses the whole question of end-of-life decisions. It's in fact called Message on End-of-Life Decisions, and it talks about withholding nutrition and hydration, refusing treatment, which is sort of extraordinary treatment, and it talks about physician-assisted suicide or physician-assisted death. And I think it's important that the church has come out with this. I think it's vitally important that the church has come out with it, because I think one of the reasons Jack Kevorkian has, or even physician-assisted suicide, the whole reason these this stuff has come up in such charged terms, either or terms. It's either physician-assisted suicide, Jack Kevorkian hospice, or suffering an unbelievably ghastly death. Is part of the reason it's come up in these stark and contrasting terms is because we haven't talked about it. We haven't realized that there are a lot of different ways to approach death, and there are a lot of different ways in which death occurs. One person said to me that he thought that the church should start to see itself as a midwife for those who are approaching death. He said, normally, the process of birth is a fairly simple one. It can be painful, you have to be careful, but you don't really need a lot of care unless something goes wrong. With death, also, given a sort of a reasonable outlook, good medical care, a good relationship with a physician who knows who you are, knows what you want, death is part of the physician-patient responsibility, or part of the dynamic. A physician knows you will die, particularly physicians who are geriatricians. And they have a responsibility and a relationship with you which will allow you to die in comfort and in peace, and having your decisions and your autonomy respected. It's the times when we don't have that relationship that death becomes very problematic, it seems to me. Now, I'm sure there are many exceptions to this, but, and we don't have any other vehicles set up, or very few of them, with which we can talk about death, the difficult deaths. And I think it's very important that the church start to acknowledge that people are having very difficult times with these things. There's a lot of suffering going along. There are a lot of personal decisions being made, and the church has not said has not helped us to think about these things. I think one of the basic problems is we don't know even if we are allowed to take our own lives, if we are allowed to say this is enough. You know, if the church says all life in and of itself is of the highest value, then how do we as members of that church, or as members of a human society which across different traditions holds up human life as the ultimate value, how do we then negotiate our deaths within that framework? And I was very happy to see that the church, the Lutheran church in this case, has said, talking about recognizing that a person is the prime decision maker in terms of how their life and death should be determined and orchestrated, and that they respect that and think that that is good and right. It says the patient is also a person in relationship, not an isolated individual. Her or his decisions should take others into account and be made in supportive consultation with family members, close friends, pastors, and healthcare professionals. Christians face end-of-life decisions in all their ambiguity, knowing that we are responsible ultimately to God, whose grace comforts, forgives, and frees us in our dilemmas. Now, what that says to me is a couple of things. That it is right and good that we decide, we make some decisions about how we're going to face the end of our life, particularly when we're confronted with them. It also suggests to me that we see that life is not in and of itself the highest good. That life is a good insofar as we have a life that engages us and that is engaged by others. I was listening to a tape yesterday about medical ethics, saying that life, we all know circumstances in which we would gladly give our lives for something which we see as a higher good. I would give my life for that of my nephew, for example, if I had to. I can't quite imagine a situation in which that would happen, but I would. In some conflicts, maybe, I would give my life for my country. That's harder for me to say, but I might. Not so hard for other people to say. So it's a question of how I live my life, what my life is worth, how much of it do I still have. If I'm comatose and in a hospital or at home and have no relationship with other people, if I'm unable to feel the sunlight on my skin or participate in the world and in my family, then I'm going to start to reevaluate how much my life is worth. I am not given life is worth this much, always the same at every point in time. And I think that it's very good. I read the statement that this gets out of this message as saying that we are almost responsible to consider how our life changes in terms of our relationships with others. I'm going to go through this real briefly because I think it's important. They make a couple of points here that I think will allow us to have some conversation later. They essentially say that for nutrition and hydration, which is the feeding tube, it's fine. They don't say it's fine to just withdraw nutrition and hydration, but when medical judgment determines that artificially administered nutrition and hydration will not contribute to an improvement in the patient's underlying condition or prevent death from that condition, patients may consider them unduly burdensome treatment. In these circumstances, it may be morally responsible to withhold or withdraw nutrition and hydration and allow death to occur. In terms of refusing treatment, they have much the same position. When you or your spokesperson decide that your life is not going to be maintained at any quality level, it's all right to say enough is enough now. Let's not use extraordinary means. Let's change the phase. Let's change what's happening here with my physician and my family and myself from a mindset of curing this disease to comforting me and helping me heal while I go through the phase of dying. That's a very different thing. Neither position suggests that you are not going to receive care. Neither position says that you are wrenched out of relationship with your community. But what they are saying is there's a different emphasis here. We can now see that dying is what's going to happen, and our care and comfort has to be differently directed so that you are not in terrible pain, either emotionally or physically or spiritually, and it's all right to start to let go. They do a little bit of a fancy dance on the physician-assisted suicide, and I have to say that this bothers me a little bit. They started by saying, is it ever morally permissible for a physician deliberately to act or authorize an action to terminate the life of a patient? This is obviously a thorny question. I'm not so surprised what the ELCA comes up with in response is somewhat ambiguous. I don't think I would feel comfortable being anything less than ambiguous either, except that I think that they ought to acknowledge that there is a great deal of ambiguity in here and that these are questions that are holding up a lot of people, particularly since we understand that most people don't have the luxury of a real great relationship with their physician. They are frequently left out in the cold. They want to know what to do, and I think it would be nice if the church would say a little bit more about this. And I will back up again. In terms of physician-assisted suicide, there's what's called the passive and the active role that a physician can take. A physician who is treating you can provide you with adequate pain management medication so that you know that if you take a lot more than they tell you, you will die. And that's sort of giving you the means whereby you can end your own life. That's called a passive physician-assisted suicide. The more active one is when you will go to the physician and say, give me something. I want you to do something for me, and I want you to essentially end my life. Is there a difference between those two? Yeah, I would say there is. But both of them will end your life. The ELCA message says the responsibility that a physician has to a patient may include the aggressive management of pain, even when it may result in an earlier death. Now that is what's called passive physician-assisted suicide, and that is, I think, what the ELCA is tacitly allowing, saying this is okay. However, the deliberate action of a physician to take the life of a patient, even when this is the patient's wish, is a different matter. As a church, we affirm that deliberately destroying life created in the image of God is contrary to our Christian conscience. While this affirmation is clear, we also recognize that responsible healthcare professionals struggle to choose the lesser evil in ambiguous borderline situations. For example, when pain becomes so unmanageable that life is indistinguishable from torture. However, we oppose the legalization of physician-assisted death. To me, this is, come on, what are you saying? Is it okay or isn't it okay? So we're no better. The church is not giving us any kind of a clear guideline. I think what it's trying to get us to read into this is that don't ask, don't tell, just say you're in a lot of pain and make sure you've got a real full prescription of pain meds and you can do what you want. But this highlights, I think, the biggest problem that we're facing, which is that these decisions are then thrown back on the individual, thrown back on the family, and are again, what is the biggest problem with this question, is that we are seeing ourselves out of relationship. We're seeing ourselves as pulled away from a community. We have to make these very bitter decisions on our own or with our family. We have to recognize that we are not really sanctioned by the church. We're not really legally, what we're doing is not legally sanctioned in any forthright manner. And we are not being nurtured and nourished and helped by our community. We can't talk about these things. We can't openly address these questions. We can't come right out and say to our physician, look, I want to make sure that their prescription has enough so that when I take them tonight, I will not wake up tomorrow morning. Oh, no, 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 I can't do that. Everything's sort of got to be under the rug or around the side. This is perhaps unavoidable at this early stage of these questions, but I think it creates a lot of problems for all of us. Which is why I want to shift into hospice. Hospice is an old idea, developed maybe 600 years ago when church people took in those who were homeless, helpless, in need of food, shelter, clothing, medical care. These were places that you could come, almost a sanctuary, a place that you could go and be helped and sort of set back up on your way and left off. Over time, and especially in England, this changed to mean a more of a hospital-like setting in which people who were in either indigent or in suffering tremendously were given a place to end their life, or to, many of them, to rehabilitate their life and to go along. Hospice is now becoming a very important part of healthcare, and that it recognizes that people whose lives are ending are in no less need of care and support and nurturing and nourishment than those who are having medical care and going to a healing process or some sort of a cure in which their life will be continued. I think as a church or as religious communities or as people of conscience and community, we could have it with very easily within our grasp to set up a hospice mentality. Because after all, hospice is not really a place so much as it is a concept. And for most people, the suffering that leads them to go to a Jack Kevorkian is a suffering that is of not only a physical pain, but of a kind of an anguish of separation from community, separation from those things which make our life worth living. And there's no, with some, again, there will always be exceptions, but I think most people who see physician-assisted suicide as the only way out of their suffering are people who have not had the community rally to their support. Most people who are dying have the care is extremely burdensome on them. It's terrible for their families if they have families. The church always talks about how, well, you know, whatever God wants, when it's God's time, you'll go. Many physicians are reluctant to shift into a phase in which you acknowledge that the illness will be cured. Will not be cured. They're reluctant to shift into a phase where now their care is directed at comfort and a kind of a spiritual and inward healing in which people can come together, have their last moments, and leave life. And I think that hospice could solve almost all of these problems. Which is a very big statement, but I really do believe it. There are very few situations, I think, in which suffering, in which people facing the end of their life cannot be helped to leave that life through a loving, caring group. People who will care for their medical needs, for their pain medication, for their financial burdens. How are they going to live? Where are they going to live? Who's going to take care of them? Can my family be with me? I don't want to be in a hospital separated from my family. Hospice can come, as I say, it's a concept rather than a place. hospice and almost all over the United States is an organization or a series of organizations which have people that will come to your home and they will help. They will bring social workers, clergy, physicians, nursing care.
And volunteers.
But people who, you're retaining your life, your whole sense of life as relationship, as relationality, as sort of a sense of who you are by the markers you have around you, is maintained. And so you can end your life as you have lived your life. And I think that's a real good idea. Have any of you had experiences with hospice? And can you?
I started training in a health agency with it. I didn't finish, so I have not been a volunteer yet. But many of my friends have, and they go through a 50-hour training through home health agencies. And then they're, they go through many things, such, you know, all sorts of training dealing with people, death and really wonderful training, and they can't be a volunteer until they do. And then they are assigned to a family, and it's usually not the person, it's a whole family that they take on. And that's part of the, that's really an intense thing. Sometimes they're called upon any hour of the day, and they're to stay with that family until death, and sometimes afterwards because of the grieving and all of that. And a friend of mine who just went through dealing with the family last summer, and she's now taking some time off because she felt burned out for a while, and that's part of what happens sometimes, was dealing with the family. The patient was fine, but the family had a lot of guilt, a lot of issues that they never discussed, and a lot of things came out from their past lives and relationships with them. This was a mother and a daughter. The daughter had her family. She was having guilt feelings about not being there, all sorts of things. Sometimes resenting the volunteer being able to be there when she could, all sorts of these things. And that goes into a lot of other things. But it's wonderful because it gives a sense of community. And also, the volunteer who is living in the same community can also help the patient to deal with the interests of her own, connect with the community as she wishes or he wishes. So it's wonderful. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Any of the others of you? Have you, any of you had any experiences with hospice? It's a funny kind of a thing. In terms of 3 years ago, for those of you who were here yesterday, I'll just do a little backtrack. 3 years ago, there was the Patient Self-Determination Act was put into law by Congress, which allowed, it was in December of 1991, which mandated that any hospital, nursing home, or HMO that received federal funding had to provide any and all patients that came in to see them with advanced directives, which living wills and durable powers of attorney, so that it said that it recognized that patients and their families had a very strong interest in controlling how the end of their life was orchestrated, the extent of medical treatment they received, and that they this then made it a legal right. Hospice, which has been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, has developed ever more quickly as a result of that legislation, because people are deciding, when I face the end of my life, I want to, most more importantly than anything, is I want to make sure that I face the end of my life as I faced the rest of my life. I don't want to give up who I am any more than I have to. Now, obviously, in the end, I will give up who I am. I will be no longer here in the same sense that I am now. What will happen to me afterwards? Depending on what your religious tradition is, you may have greater or lesser answers to those things. But hospice says that period of time in which you are dying is an extremely fertile and important time of life. It's not only an important time for you, but it's an important time for everyone around you. And where I see it as a ministry student, that we are losing a lot of this, is it's also an important time for the church or for any community that we are seeing ourselves as being part of. These are the times when the greatest questions of meaning and value and suffering are asked. And depending on how things work out, they are either answered or not answered, they're answered better or worse, or they're shunted aside and a great deal of damage is done to the whole family community unit. I think as churches, we lose a lot by not acknowledging the role that death plays in each and every life. We celebrate a number of things in life. Baptism is a very important part of life, and a part important part of our church life. We don't do an awful lot with the process of dying, what that means, how that lifts up really significant questions of suffering. And I think that what happens in hospice is that there is an intentional focus on not only the physical care that a person requires, but the care that the entire family group requires and needs, and the questions that are being lifted up, the kind of support that's needed. I truly wonder how many people that Kevorkian has dealt with, how many of them had a viable alternative, who felt that their dignity, even if as they were losing their mental capacities, in the case of one woman who, with early Alzheimer's, had Dr. Kevorkian help her die, what she would have felt if she said, no matter, it doesn't matter to my care how advanced this Alzheimer's gets, I will be treated with dignity, I will remain with my family, there will be things around me that have peopled my life, both in terms of my friends, my family, my home. The things that have been significant to me will not be taken away from me as my illness progresses. There was something I wanted to, there's a quotation here. This is from a paper written by a pastor I know who's the head of the AIDS Pastoral Care Network in Chicago. Talking about the decision for physician-assisted suicide, talking about how it's very important that there be a good, strong relationship between physician and doctor and that it should never take place outside of that, which is her argument against Kevorkian. Just the church has also an important role to play in all of this. It is a sad commentary that in a recent interview, Dr. Kevorkian said that while he had assisted persons from a variety of religious traditions, not one of them wanted a religious consultation. Religion, he said, is totally irrelevant to what they want. While one suspects that Kevorkian's own biases probably affect this report, it is probably also true that most people have not heard these issues discussed in church in any meaningful way in the life of the church. And I wonder if any of you have heard sermons on physician-assisted suicide, on hospice, on end-of-life issues. Have there been workshops held on advanced directives? I see all these shaking heads. Nobody, huh? That's a very odd thing. That's very odd.
We had an experience. I had been as a pastor 20 years in Los Angeles. And one night, just before 12 o'clock, the doorbell rang. My husband had come home and was reading. He said, I was making cookies. And he said, I have to read something before tomorrow. So he got ready for bed, and I continued to do the cookies. When the doorbell rang, I just went to the door and opened it. There stood this great big tall man, dressed beautifully, blue coat with brass buttons, and he said, "Is the father in? I would like to see the father." Well, then, of course, I knew he wasn't Protestant. He was Catholic, but he needed help. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You are the lady of the house. You are the cook." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I just have to see him." He said, "I know it's late, but," he said, "I'm taking my life tonight." And he reached in his pocket and pulled out a gun. Goodness, I'd never even seen a gun like that before. And I said, "You're going to take your life? You must be very brave." And he said, "I have to see the late father." So I left the door open, but I went to get my husband. And my husband said, "Did you let him in? Did you take him into the living room?" And I said, "No. He's got a gun." And he said, "Well, he needs help." And he said, "Go back, take him in the living room and talk to him until I get there. It'll be 2 or 3 minutes. I did. I said, we visited a minute. And I said, "Again, how brave you must be to do something like this." He said, "What's wrong?" He said, "I have nothing to live for. Nobody's ever told me it's wrong." My husband came. So they visited, for more than an hour. By that time, I was exhausted, and I kept looking in the living room, and I heard voices. I went to sleep. Suddenly I awakened and I looked quickly. I jumped up and looked into the living room. They weren't there, either one of the lights were on. That gun was on top of my grand piano. There lay that gun. I said, "Are they dead? Are they both dead?" I didn't hear a shot. But I went into the living room and are looking out the windows in the solarium. We looked right into the church and saw the altar. So I went to the window. There they both were, kneeling at the altar. Then I knew it was okay. Today that man is a great businessman in Los Angeles, living Christian man, Catholic. But life is very rich for him. And he kept saying to my husband, "Why didn't my church tell me about things like this?" So you're right, the church needs to talk about death and how we want to go and why.
I just wanted to see, because I've got to go. I came to listen, and I don't want to talk much, although I can talk about this for about an hour. I'm a medical oncologist, and I deal with hospice and cancer patients all the time. And I don't have any trouble with anything that you said, except the fact that I think the public has the misconception that the medical profession are the ones that are keeping people alive too long. I have to tell you that the biggest problem we have in medicine is that people won't let us quit. I love advanced directives. I love it. And there's when you have something like cancer, there's two hard times. There's a hard time when you find out you've got it. And that's an easy time compared to the time when, as a physician, we've got to tell people there's nothing else we can do. That's the hardest time for us. It's the hardest time for the patient. And you may think when you're feeling healthy and stuff that that you've got an idea about how you want things to go. But when you decided to battle with cancer or a lot of other things, people don't want to quit very easily. And a lot of times we know they should quit before they're willing to quit. That's a bigger problem for us. That's a bigger problem. And the reason it's a bigger problem, the reason that people aren't talking about this in their churches is because we live in a culture that really denies death. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to talk about it. And people don't want to talk about it even when they're doing battle with cancer. And it's hard.
Is it the person or the family?
It's hard to turn that corner from treatment to not to supportive care in the mind of the patient. And there's an adage, you know, and what we have to keep telling people when that time comes is that Sir William Ulster, who was a famous physician about a century ago, said, you can cure a few, you can try to heal most, but you have to take care of everybody. And the problem that I have with the physician-assisted suicide, I mean, this happens all the time. About a month ago, I unplugged somebody from a ventilator. I had a young woman with a brain tumor who got an overwhelming pneumonia. She consciously decided she wanted to be intubated, which means she can't speak anymore. Her family then became her advocates, as well as myself. I'd taken care of her for about 4 years. We decided after about a week of a pneumonia, continuing to overrun her and no hope of any recovery and having a terminal illness with her brain tumor anywhere, maybe only 6 months to live, and we were going to take her off the ventilator. And we all stood her on the bed. We had a chaplain there. We took her off the ventilator and she died in about 3 minutes. And that kind of stuff happens. We take things away that have been in place already. But that's a different matter than giving somebody an IV dose of strychnine. Mm-hmm. When somebody's in a hopeless situation, you take things away because they're not working anymore. Is a different matter than giving somebody something who may still have time to heal. But one of the problems with this business, and one of the things I like better about hospices, and the other thing I wanted to say is that there isn't much of an excuse anymore for people to be tortured with pain.
Right.
I'm involved in a thing called the Minnesota Pain Initiative, where we're trying to educate physicians in Minnesota to be freer with narcotics, to quit counting pills, to not worry about drug addiction in people that have terminal illness.
But that is a big problem, right?
It's been a big problem. I mean, everybody's afraid of drug addiction. We're in a situation where if we addict somebody to a drug without good reason, we can lose our license. You can lose your livelihood in medicine. That's one of the problems. We have
even in a terminal situation.
I think that's where it comes from.
Oh.
It comes from the fact that if somebody comes in with chronic low back pain, you wind up putting them on codeine or something stronger, and you make a drug addict out of them. You've got problems, and so that's where a lot of that comes from. That's where the reluctance comes from. And there's an educational process going on right now to try to get physicians. You know, I left a person at home who's not only on a morphine drip, he's on what's called a Versed drip, where it essentially sedates them to the point where they don't feel anything.
Right.
And it's certainly shortening their life. But I don't have any trouble with that. But there could be a time in the dying process, and nobody likes to see people suffering, but you know, suffering's part of life. And you can really take care of most people's pain, but you can't take care of their spiritual pain, their emotional pain all the time. You take care of their physical pain almost always. But I've seen too many people that really heal during the time that they're dying,
right,
to make me very excited about helping people dying quicker. I see
however,
people come together. We have memorial services in our hospice unit where people come back every 6 months, and every 6 months the other families come back for memorial service. And it's wonderful. It's one of the best times of my life in my practice to come back and meet these families again and see the families interact with their hospice nurses, and some of whom have taken care of them for months. It's tremendous.
But doesn't that healing take place in an environment which is closer to hospice than, say, a standard
ICU.
Yeah, because then it doesn't.
Most of our patients are at home. Most of our hospice patients are at home.
Yeah.
Very seldom. We have around 200 people in hospice home care, and we have an 8-bed inpatient hospice unit.
That's amazing.
40-bed oncology unit. We have 8 beds in the hospital. We have 200 patients out there at home. And they ricochet in and out of the hospital if they're at home and their pain is under control or something, they get pneumonia or something.
Give the family some respite care.
They can come in for 3, 4, 5 days and go back home again. Yeah. Most of them die at home.
Yeah.
And die with their families. And that's the way that we ought to be going with this. I don't think that you're going to get the public or the medical profession to get very excited about it. The other thing is, I told you the other day, most of my terminal patients have enough narcotics at home to kill themselves anytime they want.
Yeah, but I bet you that's a little different for people who are not dying from pain.
Right.
I mean, who are not experiencing pain.
Yeah.
If you're not having pain, but you're dying nevertheless.
If your pain's under control, I'm yet.
Then you're not going to have those narcotics available.
They just don't do that.
Yeah.
If their pain is controlled and their needs are being taken care of, they're not that anxious to end their life that quickly.
Well, there are people on ventilators or in irreversible comas who are
a small minority.
Yeah.
Most of them are at home, and most of them are around their families, and most of them have people on guru looking in on them.
Yeah.
And they're very anxious to stay living. I mean, they can't run around the block anymore, and they can't do a lot of things they used to do, but they can ratchet down their expectations.
Yeah, that's...
And still have some quality. I mean, in somebody's, what used to be important to you becomes not important anymore. And what maybe gets to be important is just being able to talk to your family. Maybe you able to read the newspaper, maybe read a book. Maybe just have somebody stop in and see it. I mean, those kinds of things, as long as, you can define quality that way, people are willing to hang on to that, want to hang on to it. It's tricky. I think we need to talk about this in our churches because I think it's part of our death-denying culture. I mean, one of the things that's pushing us to doing this is the high cost of medical care. I mean, the reason the hospice has got to be more easy is because it's too darn expensive to be in the hospital.
Yeah, and hospice saves a lot of money.
Absolutely.
And it's money that almost everybody feels quite comfortable in saving. It's not, and that's the thing that always impresses me so much about hospice, is that it's not the sense that we are taking care away. It's changing the focus of the care. Recognizing that the dying process is happening now. So what is the kind of care you require now?
Right. I'm curious to know if hospice is available all over. Because we have
there are 2,000 hospice associations in the United States. There are 40 states that have them legally licensed in one form or another. But some of that licensing is very tricky, like in Chicago or in Illinois, refuses to license any residential hospice facility whatsoever. So in that case, if you want to have hospice, you have to contact a service which will then send people to your home. That's good, but there are a lot of times, particularly for things like respite care, where the actual care of the person is exhausting. And the person can go into the hospital to give the family 2 or 3 days, or you want to go out of town for a wedding, things like that, or people who don't have that kind of family. There are an enormous number of people of the AIDS population for whom hospice is an extremely important environment.
Our home health agency has all those services within the agency, respite care, the volunteer, friendly visitor, the hospice team whole thing, and it seems to be doing up there.
Things
seems to be through the home health agencies more than.
Yeah, that's what it is in Chicago.
Home health agencies.
Yeah, they in turn have to be licensed, and they have to be because they get third-party payment and Medicare funding.
Yeah,
and
they have to be certified.
Third-party payers, then Medicare especially, demands that the people involved in that, that you know, have to jump through certain hoops, have to have certain kinds of training, certain kinds of credentials, have to keep up with their educational process, have to fulfill requirements and stuff. And that's why, you know, that's why it's oftentimes limited to a hospital-based program. They can go out in the community, but a lot of those kind of credentialing stuff still is most easily done by the hospital. That's the trouble. The third-party payers have a handle on that.
Yeah, it's... I think that there are two things going on in terms of the churches, and one of them is certainly the larger of them, is this whole death-denying culture. We are not at all comfortable with the whole notion of diminishment and of aging and dying. I mean, it's just not something we like to see. We still got this frontier mentality.
The other opportunity I think the church has, and I don't think this is very common either, but not the Lutheran church I go to in the city I live in, but another one, actually has a part-time nurse on their staff.
Yeah.
And I've got a patient who belongs to this church who's got terminal pancreatic cancer, who's actually being taken care of by the parishioners in this church. And this nurse, I work with him, I provide his morphine, and I provide his whatever else he needs for comfort, and I provide a fair amount of emotional support for him. But the hands-on stuff is done by the members of this church. And
that's wonderful.
Yeah, and they've got a half-time nurse who makes hospital visits, who makes home visits, who arranges for volunteers from their church to come in and provide care for him. His wife works in Canada. He's only going to live another 3 or 4 months, but boy, there's fertile ground out there. And you talk about cutting costs. I mean, they've taken away any health care provider but me. And with the church, and this guy's being very well taken care of. Probably better than our hospice home care patients are, mm-hmm. because he's got friends doing it.
Well, I think, you see, I mean, I've been doing geriatrics, chaplaincy, and pastoral care and medical ethics for a year and a half now. It has made my life so much richer and so much more interesting, and I feel so much more engaged and so much more able to talk about the questions of meaning and value and what it is to be alive, what it is to be dying, what it is to be in relationship with each other, that it's like this incredible resource for congregations and communities. And we're not only not accessing it, but we're sort of pushing it away so that it's something that is extremely distasteful for most churches to deal with. And I think that we can all speak up and say, what about this? How about a coffee hour on advanced directives? How about taking the different physician-assisted suicide scenarios that are in the paper every day, practically? Let's talk about them. What does this mean in terms of how we understand life, how we understand death? What should we do about it? In the city that I'm in, which is Chicago, which has an enormous medical ethics consortium, chaplaincy jobs and positions are being cut out of all major hospitals because there is no funding for them. They don't see that as an important function of medical care and of health care. There's something very wrong there. And I'm not saying this simply because that's what I want to do. It's because this is the kind of, I mean, there are thousands, millions of people dying, and we're spending billions and billions of dollars and having very unhappy experiences for most of these people. We could be doing a lot for ourselves and for each other that we are not doing now. So I'm very strongly in support of hospice. At the conference I was at a couple weeks ago, somebody said, well, all right, is there any kind of a situation, they were just addressing a panel of physicians, in which you don't think a hospice would work? And the physician sat there for a while, and one physician said, I've got it. There is a person who is driving a gasoline truck which has a terrible accident, and the gasoline truck has burst into flames, and he's in the middle of it. I would shoot him. I would not try to pull this person out and save this person's life and put him in a hospice, because the suffering is just unbelievable. I would just shoot him if I could. But aside from that, there's almost no way that they, that these physicians and these ethicists around, and nurses and other therapists, could see that we don't have it within us to provide the care and comfort that we need for ourselves and for each other. We can control pain if we agitate strongly enough. My concern about that is that a number of physicians are so reluctant to provide adequate pain care that what that you are talking about by continuing a person's life is by forcing them to suffer needlessly. I don't think that suffering per se is a good thing. I think there is suffering in life, and that some suffering is part of life. But when we have it in our means to sustain life beyond where it normally would have gone, and thereby sustain acute suffering, there's no sense to that at all.
There's two problems that we have with pain control. One is physician reluctance, but the other one is patient reluctance. We also have patients who, when you tell them it's time for some morphine, think that they're going to die right away. They associate morphine with death. And you have to give them about a half an hour pep talk on the fact that they can live on morphine, they can be more comfortable on morphine, and their appetite and performance is going to be better on morphine. And there's also a segment of the population, especially men, who are too macho to take pain pills and want to put up with the pain and want to show everybody how stoic they are. It's a real big problem. That's a bigger problem. People don't want to take them up. So there's that too.
Well, I would suppose that in a situation like that, you know, if it gets too bad, you'll finally say, all right. But it's when I see people who are suffering terribly and the physicians will not give them, say, well, this could repress respiration. Is this person dying? Is this person close? I mean, within days of death? So what? And it also gives them, I mean, those pain-free times or pain-diminished times are times in which they can say their goodbyes. They can be together with family and friends. Does this make any sense? Anybody got anything to say about this? Because I think it's a false construct to hold up that life is a fundamental value at all costs, and that therefore we don't talk about death. We then say, well, then that's the domain of the Almighty. No, it's not. We have a responsibility, along with the medical technology and legal advances that we have a responsibility, really, to think about how we want to orchestrate death, how we want to retain the highest...